Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Today speaking, we have Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of Cameco Corporation. He's going to be going through some of the developments we've seen recently in the nuclear industry and the uranium market in particular. And without further ado, I'll hand it over to Grant.
Okay, thanks, Matt. Just a bit of a sound check. You can all hear me just fine. My wife tells me I have a horrible outside voice, so I often talk too loud, especially when I'm in front of these things. So if it's overbearing, I know Jim Este will let me know back there. So I want to do a bit of a mix here because I think the theme is a fireside chat, but I do have a few comments I want to make. I want to begin, obviously, with a thank you for the opportunity to help explain our view of the uranium market in general, and then take that view and translate it into what we think our best course of action is over the next few years, over the next planning cycle. We plan on a 10-year basis is what we put out in our disclosures. I do want to just actually summarize at the beginning and then test that summary throughout and make sure I'm being consistent with it. It won't surprise you that one of the concluding comments is that we continue to view the uranium market as being in transition, transitioning from what has historically been a supply-driven or inventory-driven market to one that's truly becoming a demand-driven market. And we believe that that transition carries with it some very favorable fundamentals from a price point of view. And as such, we plan to cautiously grow as this transition occurs in order to meet the favorable prices with growing production, but from great value assets. So it is that value orientation. So a lot of times when you try to articulate a growth strategy, you do it in volume terms, and let make no mistake, it's value creation that's at the heart of these types of plans. So before we get into the Q&A, I just want to take you through five slides here. I want to tell you about our view on uranium demand and uranium supply. I want to talk about the uncertain transition path. So I boldly said that the market is in transition. The question always is, when is the transition coming? That transition path is uncertain. That uncertainty has been reflected in some of the changes of our view and our strategy. So I want to take you through the thinking there. And I want to show you what cautious growth looks like to us and the navigating points that we use as we look at growth and growth from our pipeline. And of course, you have a fuller handout, or there are handouts available than what I'll show you, but happy to go into any more detail on any of them if you wish. Of course, need to remind us all that going to be making some assumptions and drawing some conclusions from those assumptions, and those assumptions are forward-looking information, and there are risks associated with those assumptions, and we go over the risks and how they can change materially in our annual information form, in our annual MD&A, as well as in our quarterly MD&A updates. So just a reminder on the role of forward-looking information. With respect to demand, when we say that the market is transitioning, what we mean is this slide. There is real growth happening in uranium because of new reactors that are under construction. If you look at this chart, one of the on the very far column, you see 64 reactors under construction today. Our view is that in addition, there'll be probably 80, so an additional 16 on top of that in our 10-year view that we have. But the 64 under construction today, if we just put it in context, that's growth our industry hasn't seen since the late 70s when France was building and Japan was building and Western Europe, and there was construction going on in the United States. So that is real growth that's happening. Now, that's not to say the demand picture has not been affected by the events in Fukushima. We'll talk about that a little bit. So, for example, if we were having this conversation in the days before Fukushima, our view over the 10-year period would have been about 110 new reactors. It fell to 96 in the days after Fukushima, taking into account decisions made in Germany, for example, and taking into account some of the effects on Japan. And most recently, we've pushed it back down to 80. But the 64 under construction is a real number, one that you can look at the construction that's underway. When you go down the column and see the operable units of 511, from a uranium point of view, this translates into about 225 million pounds of uranium consumed on an annual basis, up from 175 million pounds today. The other thing that's interesting to note about this demand slide is the difference between uranium requirements and uranium demand. For many years in our industry, those were the same number. They were the same number because there was no new construction going on. But one of the important things that we always need to disentangle in our industry is that when you start a new reactor, you need some one-time volumes to feed it. So a new reactor has a tripartite fuel assembly. You have to fill all three chambers at once. 1.5 million pounds of uranium is required to do that. But the run rate of that reactor is a third of that a year, 500,000 pounds. So you have some one-time volumes. So when you have new construction going on, you have one-time volumes for first cores and for an inventory build. The numbers that we tend to disclose are always the requirements or the run rate numbers. We try not to mislead ourselves with one-time volumes. So the 225 million pounds a year is the requirement. On top of that, there will be a need for strategic inventories and a need for first cores, but those are one time, and they don't affect the market in a sustainable way. And in fact, if you see a lot of variation in demand forecasts, it tends to come down to the assumptions that are being assigned to strategic inventory positions, for example, of new entrants into the industry, China, for example, or India. People making assumptions about how much inventory they'll hold tends to really drive the big variances in demand. On top of that, then, is a supply picture. And while we believe that the growth picture from a demand point of view is actually quite certain and predictable, reactors don't sneak up on anybody. They're projects that are licensed and permitted well ahead of time. They're major construction projects, and they don't just suddenly arrive. We do believe there's far less certainty and predictability around the supply of uranium. We see supply decisions being made today for future production, decisions to defer, delay, if not some outright cancel projects that, before Fukushima, we were assuming we're going to be in the market competing with our pounds, for example. So we have seen a bit of supply destruction as a result of Fukushima. But ultimately, what we do is we see a gap. We see a gap between demand and supply because of two features. One is, as demand grows to 225 million pounds of production a year, or consumption a year, it's important to remember primary production is only 145 million pounds. The gap between today's consumption of 175 and today's production of 145 has been filled by secondary supplies historically. This is at the heart of my comment that we're transitioning from a supply-driven industry. 24 of those 30 million pounds have been one single source of secondary supply, and that's the HEU agreement. And that's an agreement to downblend Russian warheads, and it's agreement that comes to an end at the end of this year. And there is no source of supply of that scale or scope to plug it in the immediate term. So we have a dynamic where demand is more certain and predictable, and supply is less certain and predictable, and in fact, some known sources of supply are going away. And ultimately, on a cumulative basis, this opens up an opportunity of new supply around 360 million pounds of uranium. So ultimately, you can imagine that as a primary producer, we get pretty excited about that. In a supply-driven industry or an inventory-driven industry, primary producers typically don't hold the leverage in that industry. Secondary supplies do. So as the secondary supplies diminish in importance, the primary producers actually obtain a bit more leverage. It's an exciting place to be for a primary producer. So the supply and demand picture get us excited over the long term. But make no mistake, the last few years and the next few remain uncertain. They remain uncertain because of an event that took place on March 11th, 2011, and that is the earthquake and tsunami in Fukushima and the impacts that it had on the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, and then the knock-on effects on power generation, nuclear power generation in Japan, and the reverberations that then has created around the industry. And during that time, you've seen a slow drift down of the long-term price of uranium and actually quite an initial rapid fall in the price of the spot price of uranium, which has then continued to drift. And if we thought about the dynamic behind that, I think it's important to understand that, you know, as we go on this transition path, the last 18 months really are characterized as a disaster met an industry that was already in a discretionary mode. And by that, I mean The existing producers were well covered in their sales volumes going forward. The existing customers were well covered in their requirements out to 2015 and 2016. And we were in a market where there was just a lot of discretion. That changed in the summer of 2010 when the Chinese showed up to do long-term contracting for their new construction and their new units that would start operating 2015 and beyond. But when Fukushima happened, the fuel buyers stepped back. The Chinese stepped out of the market. The existing customer base stepped out of the market. And I think it's a very rational response where we're saying, we know we need to worry about long-term supply, and we know we need to do long-term contracting. But the uncertainty that's created by Japan's a country that relies heavily on nuclear power. They're responsible for about 20 million pounds of consumption a year. They have bigger inventory positions than others do. That uncertainty makes me think that this is probably a price-off situation. So the fuel buyer is weighing their long-term needs with their short-term opportunity, and by and large made the decision to step back out of the market. And quite frankly, they've been rewarded for it because many of the producers did precisely the same thing. Many of the producers covered out for the next couple years also said, these are not the conditions under which we want to contract. And market activity went very quiet. And we really haven't seen that resumption of long-term contracting in a substantial way in our market. So that remains the catalyst. Just like 2010, the catalyst for the price run was long-term contracting. That's the catalyst today. Back then, it was the Chinese showing up. It's not clear that they'll be the first mover this time. We're now within the five-year window of the 2015-2016 period. Typically in our industry, that's the fuel buying behavior. You show up for long-term contracting about 5 years before you need that material. But in today's uncertain market, the fuel buyer wants to wait it out, make sure they've found the lowest price before they rebase their next long-term contracting conversations. So the catalyst is that return to long-term contracting, and that is really affected by Japanese restart plans, the view of excess inventories in the market, and the impacts or the ending of the HEU deal that we talked about. So in the near term, we still have uncertainty. There's no doubt about it. Our view is over the longer term, the fundamentals remain, and they remain very favorable. So of course, that makes us follow a cautious growth program. Many of you were familiar with our plans to double our uranium production to 40 million pounds a year. We've pulled that back. It's now a 36 million pound a year, so annual consumption, by 2018. And we've pulled it back on a couple of principles. Before, in order to get to 40 million pounds, it required some greenfield projects to come into development. We've pulled those out and said, no, the market has to signal those projects. So that would be like our Kintyre project, for example, or our Millennium project. And we focused on the ones that where we can leverage brownfield opportunities. So bring Cigar Lake into production, for example. That's 9 million pounds a year, our share, when it's up and running at full capacity. Expand MacArthur River. Continue our increase in production in our US operations. And extend the life of our Rabbit Lake asset. And then take our projects like Kintyre, our newly acquired Yeelirrie project, as well as our Millennium project, and park those until the market is calling for them. So just like others, we have responded by pulling back on our supply plans, exacerbating that gap that's in the market. So when I say our cautious growth, it's cautious because it's leveraging brownfield, and it's really focusing on those tier one assets. And what I mean is those tier one assets that have life of mine operating costs that are competitive in any price cycle. We've put out some technical reports on these assets in the last couple years. So Cigar Lake, $18.60 a pound life of mine operating costs. MacArthur River, a brand new technical report came out last year, $19.23 a pound life of mine operating costs. Our Inkai property, $17.55 a pound life of mine operating costs. The projects that aren't as clearly tier one assets are Kintyre project. We put out the preliminary results of our pre-feasibility study. We told the market that it requires a $67 uranium price or a 60 million pound denominator to make that asset attractive. Goes into the bullpen in today's price environment. So that's what we mean when we say cautious growth for Cameco. So with that, I am anxious to get to the Q&A. I hope that kind of gives you a very quick snapshot of the fundamentals as we see them and how we intend to respond to them. So with that, you moderating the questions?
Yeah, come have a seat, Grant.
Great, thank you.
So we'll open it up to the floor for any questions at this time.
Yeah, so the question about, I was asked to repeat the questions because it's webcast. So we had a very good look at the pre-feasibility stage with that obvious caveat around it, but we had a very good look at that asset to make sure we understood it. We do think it confirmed our understanding of the costs involved with bringing greenfield production in. We'd sort of said for many years that, you know, uranium's going to come from four different regions that fall into three different cost categories. You know, we've always looked at northern Saskatchewan and Kazakhstan. While they're completely different mining types and they're completely different deposits, they end up with very similar life of mine operating costs. And those are the tier one assets in our industry. Beyond that, we looked at Western Australia, and Australia in general is sort of tier two. Those are the open pit assets. You know, good grades, but you do have a fairly big denominator to make those effective. And Kintyre just didn't have that. It's a smaller deposit. And our view of Kintyre really confirmed that Western Australia, life of mine operating costs, you know, probably in the $35 to $45, maybe $50 per pound operating cost range. We've never ventured into Africa from an investment point of view. And the reason was, all the work that we did many years ago and continue to refresh indicated that on a capital basis, on an operating basis, on a true infrastructure cost basis, those were really tier three costs, or at least that was our view, and that's kept us out of Africa. So Kintyre was confirmatory for us rather than, you know, sort of discovering, boy, it's going to be expensive. It actually confirmed what was our view.
Go ahead.
So the question about the acquisitions that we've made, and of course, we've made three. Two of them were assets, and one of them was a service firm, NuChem, a trading group. So let's start with the assets first. From an M&A point of view, and you've heard us say, Bruce, and others have as well, that we have a very big portfolio of pounds in the ground. And really, we were just simply being opportunistic. We weren't actually looking to grow that asset base, but we did find in both the case to acquire a greater share of the Millennium asset in northern Saskatchewan and the opportunity with Yeelirrie, we found a motivated seller on an exclusive basis for attractive per pound valuations relative to transactions that had been completed in the last couple years. I mean, you always do that comparison that's both proximate from a time point of view and a geographic and a geologic point of view. Yeelirrie is a very good example. Western Australia, on the heels of putting out a pre-feasibility study that said, you know, Kintyre needed a higher price, Yeelirrie came along, and it was an opportunity for us that, quite frankly, on a per pound basis was below our finding costs in Western Australia. It was just an opportunity, and an opportunity we're still very excited about. But by and large, from an acquisition point of view, our priority is pounds in the can, not pounds in the ground. That doesn't mean we won't look at a good opportunity if it comes our way, but we're just not out hunting for them on an asset basis like that. NuChem was different. NuChem's a brokerage firm. You did see in the one chart about supply that secondary supplies will continue to play a role in our market. Not of the size and scale of the HEU agreement, but they'll continue to be there. And not only that, especially in the circumstance we're in right now where, you know, you've got a large nuclear fleet in Japan that's idle. That creates some excess inventory situations, which means there's going to be secondary supplies available. And NuChem was a an outfit that they were being sold by their parent company. They were going to go somewhere. We'd been competing with them for years. They're the best at what they do. It's not core for us. It's always going to be a segment on the side. But it's a segment that we would rather participate in than be victimized in, because, quite frankly, they were the best at it. So it was one where the opportunity was right. And it isn't an opportunity that would have been available had Fukushima not occurred, probably. So those were just opportunistic actions on our part. You see that what we don't do is we don't take many steps when the uranium price is going up. So we just found the conditions were right. Valuations had finally come within our target range, and we wanted to take advantage of them.
Some of the assumptions that you made, particularly with respect to the Schultz curve and the nuclear industry as a whole, are predicated on basically Chinese coming in and playing games that you know whatever the house was. My experience of that's what they do. Certainly there's, as you well know, there's differences between how the Japanese play the game and how the Americans play the game in terms of purchases.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an absolutely great question. There is no doubt there's a fundamental transition that's going to happen on the customer side of the industry. The largest fleet right now is the United States. In the United States, I think we have 43 different customers. China, within the next 10 to 15 years, could have the largest nuclear fleet, and there'll probably only be two customers. So that creates a very interesting dynamic, there's no doubt about it. But we do have experience with our Chinese customers. We did do some long-term contracting with them in 2010. We've begun to do deliveries. We understand their behavior and their commitment to the long-term contracts and feel very comfortable that these are transactions that are of the type and of the nature that we see in our industry. And they haven't exhibited any behavior that suggests they want to do things differently. Yeah. So when they showed up in 2010, it was bang on the typical behavior in the industry. They have a big construction program underway right now, 26 reactors under construction. 5 years before those flip into commissioning, they were long-term contracting. And that was just very typical behavior. Right now, I think the dynamic is just slightly different. The uncertainty about Japan and the effect that that creates on the price and the opportunity to wait, get back into long-term contracting at a lower price, rebase the conversations, has affected all the fuel buyers. I don't think it's affected China any differently than the others, but their initial behavior was very consistent with the underlying behaviors in our industry. Yeah, so right now our official numbers, and that was part of the reduction in our net new reactors, is to take German policy absolutely at face value. Notwithstanding, if there is a reversal, that'll be the third time. The plan was to extend the life of the operating units. There's something fundamentally inescapable in both the German situation and the Japanese situation. They both have export-driven industrial growth models. And those models are only successful if you have cheap baseload power. And those models in both those countries have required the very simple bargain: the state provides cheap baseload power, or enables the provision of cheap baseload power. Industry makes the investments for jobs, and the system works. And remember that in the fall of 2010, the Germans did make the policy decision to extend the operating life of all their reactors by an average of 14 years. So it was only a couple months later that they went into, let's shut everything down by 2022 again. That decision in 2010 was based upon, in the fall of 2010, it was based upon one of those fairly large studies that it was an industrial study, it was an energy policy study. lots of stakeholders involved, a high level of participation, with some very simple conclusions. And at the time, 25% of the Germans really didn't like nuclear power, but the conclusion was 100% of Germans don't like rolling blackouts. So now, here we are, post-Fukushima, the number might be 35% don't like nuclear power, but it's still 100% that don't like rolling blackouts, and nothing's been done to fundamentally change that equation. So that does put pressure, but that is a speculation on a policy change. Our numbers just take the policy at face value and phase out. But it is interesting because in the days after Fukushima, because the decision had been taken to extend the life of the operating reactors, four reactors were already shut down for refurbishment. They then shut down the four next oldest reactors, and then there's nine left running. And even if you do the math and assign all the inventory from the ones that are shut down to the reactors that are running, and then model it out to 2022, they still don't have enough uranium to take them to 2022, so they'll still have to buy uranium in the market, even though the plan is to shut down. So it is an interesting case, and one that we watch quite closely. But it is tied up in political economy dimensions that are certainly beyond me.
Maybe really quickly, you could just kind of walk us through what you're seeing happening on the ground in Japan right now, what your Japanese utility customers are saying to you about their possible demand outlook for 2013, 2014.
So in Japan, just mindful of the time here, a couple of very interesting developments. There now is a fourth arm of government responsible for regulating the nuclear industry. The Nuclear Regulatory Agency is in place, legislative powers. They quickly came out of the gate and said, look, a number of you were in the process of being evaluated under the new stress test. We're cranking everybody back to the start line. We're reviewing that process, and we'll tell you later whether you can go in it. So it's sort of mid-2013 before utilities will be able to take their assets back into that process. But interestingly, our customers, in anticipation of the changes in the regulatory requirements, have begun to invest in their assets. We're watching as they're investing, taking the mitigating steps. They have choices. These are the utilities that could be investing in natural gas. They could be investing in coal. They're investing in their nuclear power plants. Another interesting positive for us is that the Japanese, through various consortia, and in some cases directly, the utilities are invested in uranium projects. TEPCO, for example, is in one of the joint venture partners in the Cigar Lake project. We thought that Fukushima might be an opportunity to maybe obtain a greater chunk of Cigar Lake. In all of our partnerships, none of our Japanese partners want to exit those uranium projects. And that's an interesting data point as well. So cautiously optimistic on Japan.
Perfect. Well, that's actually all the time that we have allocated for today's presentation. Thank you very much for coming in and speaking with us today. No problem.